Accession number 22155, Reel 1.
And if I could ask you, first of all, Martin, to tell me something about your family background. Whereabouts were you born?
I was born at Reddisham in Suffolk, which is East Suffolk, near the Norfolk border, in August 1938. My father was a country author, Adrian Bell, distinguished in his day and well remembered today. There even exists an Adrian Bell Society. He wrote some 20 country books. He was the founder of the Times Crossword Puzzle. He was at that time still a farmer, a small farmer, which he gave up in about 1956. His father was the news editor of The Observer in the 1930s, Robert Bell. He put out the newspaper while J.L. Garvin, the celebrated editor, was going around the country houses and generally getting it wrong, in my view. He was an opponent of appeasement before the war, but it's not my grandfather's fault. My other grandfather, my mother's father, was military. His name was Captain W.J. Gibson. He was the second director of music of the Lifeguards, sometime about the mid-20s. And I realized what how difficult it for him it must have been, because suddenly here he was a musician. To be director of music in a Guards band, you are a musician. And suddenly, for the first time, there's a bandmaster figure among the officers. I think they must have, knowing the Guards as I do, I think it must have been quite difficult for him. But we know nothing about it because my grandmother hated the army and all it stood for. My mother was born in Potchefstroom. They served in India and South Africa, all over the world, and she hated it. And she destroyed every photograph that ever existed, all those Trooping the Colours that my grandfather must have done. The only memento we found in the attic, a whole mass of very early 78 records of the Band of the Lifeguards in action, which completely, they must have been his free copies from the gramophone company, not just military marches, but Gilbert and Sullivan and more ambitious pieces. And they were unplayed, virgin records, and I gave them to the, about 4 or 5 years ago, I gave them to the Guards Museum in Windsor, and they were grateful to have them. So it's the family background is partly journalistic, partly literary, and on one side, military.
How about siblings?
My siblings are much more distinguished than I am. I'm a twin. My sister Sylvia married a curate, and because you couldn't live in a curate's stipend in those days, went off to Canada and lives in Canada. He was the head of the theological faculty at Toronto University. My elder sister Anthea is does many things, but she's a professional translator. One of her claims to fame is she translated Willy Brandt's memoirs from German into English. And even more, she's the English translator of the Asterix cartoons. She is the brains of the family, as well as being the family's residual archivist.
How about your education? Would this have been interrupted at all with the war, World War II?
Not really. I have very little memory of World War II. I was born at the end of August 38. I remember searchlights, because, of course, the whole of East Anglia was like an aircraft carrier, really. It was flat, it was close to the continent, and there were airfields everywhere. I don't remember anything more than that, and I remember the butterfly bombs that fell around and some in the ditch. And the prisoners of war who worked on my father's farm, who were totally charming, both Germans and Italians. And my mother looked after the Italians especially well. She did up the stable into her home. She learned to cook spaghetti, and when they left, they cried. They'd never been so well treated in their lives. They had a good time.
You haven't said much about your mother.
My mother, well, she was the dynamo of the family. My father did the talking. She milked the goats. She lit the fires. She was a secretary briefly before she married him. She devoted herself to sort of task of unpaid servant, as people did in those days, bringing up the family, looking after them, keeping him going. He was hopeless on his own. He got merely miserable on his own, and he needed her badly. It was a very happy marriage and a serene background, which is very disappointing to the psychiatrists. But really, I had no traumas as a young man, whatever.
And your education?
Away all the time, I was sent to a boarding school which my parents could not afford, at Taverham Hall, north of Norwich, when I was 8, and I stayed there till I was 12. They couldn't find a local school in which they had sufficient confidence. And when I was 12, I was sent to the Lees at Cambridge, which is, was and is, I suppose, a sort of second grade, but good second grade of public school, a Methodist foundation. It seemed to be mostly for the sons of the northern mill owners who were Methodists. I first encountered Yorkshiremen there. And I was there from the ages of, well, maybe 12 and a half, maybe 13 to 17 and a half, when I passed my entrance examination to King's College, Cambridge, and was taken out immediately because my father couldn't possibly pay those fees for no purpose. And when I was nearly 18, which was in June 1957, I was conscripted, of course, into the Suffolk Regiment. There was no choice in those days. The only choice I would have had was to do the soldiering after I was a student at Cambridge. And if I'd done that, I wouldn't have had to do the soldiering, but I didn't know that. I thought I'd get it over with. Probably those 2 years probably gave me a better education than all the, I suppose, the 10 years earlier at boarding school, because I was out of my rather safe and secure environment, really thrown in at the dark end with deep end with people shouting at me and being obliged to do things I really didn't want to do. Basic training was in Bury St Edmunds, and then in September we were shipped off to September 57. I took my first flight in a Comet from Southend Airport, which took us to Nicosia, where the battalion was. It was based in a camp near the airport, and from September 57 until the whole of 58, really until the end of May 59, I served in Cyprus with the 1st Battalion on a number of duties. It was internal security, it was dealing with AOKA, quote, terrorism, unquote. We were one of the county battalions assigned to Nicosia, the city, because they felt that the Scots and Irish were better off in the mountains and could do less damage, and we were thought to be steadier. And we spent a lot of time policing very aggressive demonstrations by the Turkish Cypriots. And I regret to say that in one of these, six Turkish Cypriots was shot dead. I heard very few shots fired in anger in my nearly 2 years there. I was in the intelligence section, which mostly provided maps for the officers and dealt with radio communications. And when I joined, it was 8 strong, and when I left, I was it. And miraculously, they even made me an acting sergeant before I left. The seminal point for me was failing my WASB, which is the War Office Selection Board, because I was a college boy, so I should be an officer, shouldn't I? And so we were all rounded up and sent off to this place in Westbury in Wiltshire, which still is. It's now called the Regular Commissions Board. And you're then required to do things with planks and ropes and show leadership, which I had no idea about. I'm not a practical chap. And I think I was rather diffident and shy. And years later, Robin Searby, a brigadier I know very well, was the brigadier in charge of that place, and he invited me back. And they actually looked at my card from the card index, and it showed that I had failed my intelligence test and had to resit it. And I was a very marginal case, and it all depended on a final interview with the brigadier. And the brigadier decided I was not officer material, and I'm sure the brigadier was right. He did me a huge favor, especially when I saw the people they did make officers. I was quite glad not to be one. And those 2 years in the ranks were really, I think, the making of me. No privileges. You do it the hard way. And I learned fieldcraft. I learned basic how to handle a weapon. I learned military formations. I learned a lot of stuff that came in useful later in my career, because soldiers will relate much more. Soldiers that are a bit suspicious of journalists, but they will relate much more easily to a soldier who has been a journalist and has done the business. And indeed, after a man of certain years, has been through more front lines than most of them have seen. But it was the basic training that made it all possible, something called fieldcraft.
So your national service, you know, how you regard it, obviously with the benefit of hindsight and later experience, as very valuable. But at the time, did you know?
At the time, I thought it was pretty much a waste of time. I spent an awful lot of time asleep, staying out of trouble, not being noticed. It was not the most exacting military service ever. There were on Sundays the trucks would go to the beach and we'd hang out there. Very little contact with the real world. I had no idea what was going on politically. I didn't understand what we were doing. But I do remember being lectured about it. I was with an interpreter from the intelligence corps, a chap called Dunkley, who understood it very well and was arguing with the intelligence officer all the time about the morality of what we were doing. We were colonial troops. We were doing a colonial job. We were standing between the Greek Cypriots and their independence, or for that matter, the Turkish Cypriots and theirs. I think General Harding was then the governor. I used to write regular letters home, and looking at them years later, I thought, what a limited young man this was, you know, with no interest or apparently curiosity in what was going on.
Were you getting any experience of journalism?
Only to the extent that I edited the regimental magazine called Castle and Key, and contributed a few anonymous odes and ditties to it, of a kind which, if I'd signed them, would have had me marched straight down to the guardroom. But I did, in the course of that time, I got to see the world's media in action for the first time. We surrounded and searched a Turkish Cypriot suburb of Nicosia, looking for offensive weapons, because there's been a lot of knifing and bayoneting of people, and many of them weren't much more than kitchen knives. Some were clubs, and I remember them being all laid out on tables. It was quite a coup at the time, and the journalists came to inspect, and I thought, that's an interesting job. They didn't seem to be doing very much. They were very sharply dressed in their safari suits with their suede shoes, and I thought, and they're living in great style at the Lidra Palace Hotel, and I remember reflecting, that'd be a good way to earn a living, you know. And I subsequently got to know some of them when I became, these are the old school legends in their time, but now forgotten, Donald Wise of the Daily Mirror, who served in the Suffolk Regiment, John Osman, who had great difficulty working in Cyprus with a name like Osman, but in fact is as British as I am. There were various legends around. It was, I suppose, the golden age of Fleet Street, and I just actually came in on the end of it before it ended.
Did you have any sort of... you would have been there, I think, at the time when Bishop Makarios came back. Is that right? From the Seychelles and Athens?
I think I'd gone by then. I do remember being involved in one of many operations where we thought we'd tracked the secret hideout of Colonel Grivas. It meant surrounding a house in the suburbs of Nicosia. If the bird was there, he'd flown. But I remember it was sort of pretty exciting at the time. You know, we always imagined that a vast amount of regimental glory to be earned from this. The regiment had actually killed one of his deputies, a man called Nikos Sampson, in the mountains the year before. It was a good regiment. It had distinguished itself in Malaya. Very steady. I suppose I can say this for the archive. I don't think it had the best commanding officer there ever was. I don't think he'd go past major these days. But he was well supported. Good officers. Colonel Bertie Bevan, BEAVAN. He wrote a book about his life called something about Tapis. There was an awful lot of India in it. Very much a regimental officer of the old school, with all the advantages and limitations that implies. But his deputy was Colonel Arthur Campbell, who wrote Jungle Green, who was one of the most inspiring officer I ever met, a wonderful man. Died young, but he took over the battalion from Bevan, and he was absolutely the sort of inspirational soldier who I think they wouldn't promote these days, because they're very worried about, they don't like having charismatic officers. They think it means trouble.
Were you also meeting a much broader range of people, you know, having come from a sort of boarding school?
Well, I was inside the battalion in and so on, yeah. It was certainly not officers' mess stuff, and that was a great advantage for me. And I had to hold my own with them because I was supposed to talk posh. Well, I didn't really talk posh at all. But, you know, I was a college boy, and they were singled out for extra fatigues for that reason, you know. Yeah. But it was all right, if you do the business. And, of course, because I could write, I became useful to them. I would advise the other soldiers on their spelling, and if they filled in forms, I'd help them fill in forms. And then I was the secretary of the corporal's mess because I could do my sums. And so they used such academic talents as I had. And as I said, I edited Castle and Key, the magazine, and corrected the signals officer on his grammar, which he didn't appreciate. Those were different times. That's where he said, the trouble with you, Corporal Bell, is that you think too much.
So after National Service, was it Cambridge?
After National Service was more or less straight to Cambridge. I came out in mid-June 1959. In July, I was sort of steeping myself back in a sort of summer school atmosphere at King's. And I went up there in September, October 1959, and spent 3 years there, happy years.
What were you reading?
I was reading English. I think I worked too hard. I knew my parents couldn't afford all this stuff, although I got a state scholarship as well as an exhibition, so it wasn't too burdensome on my father. He still had to pay more money than he could really afford, and I felt that I really had to come out with a good degree in order not to fail them, because he was rather proud. He'd never been to university. He said he'd been to the University of Life. In fact, as a young man, he was once accosted by the bulldogs in Cambridge, who suspected that he was a university student not properly dressed, because in the evening you had to wear gowns. Even in my time you had to wear gowns, so he convinced them he wasn't actually a student at all. He was an apprentice farmer at the time. So I probably worked too hard. I did a little bit outside. I got involved in the University Liberal Club mildly. I was a member of the Union Society. I did nothing about it because I was rather put off by the arcane rituals of the debates there, much as I was later to be by the imitation debates in the House of Commons. I mean, each is an imitation of the other. And I never liked the confrontational style. But I did little bits and that, little bits of this and that. And towards the end of my time, I was able to do a little bit of discreet freelancing for the BBC of university stories. And here, this is how I got into that, is pure nepotism, because the father of an ex-girlfriend of mine, Kenneth Matthews, something of a legend in the BBC. He was the foreign news editor at some time. He was a war correspondent in the Greek Civil War. He got captured. They never forgave him for getting captured and assigned him to do the obituaries after that. I don't know why it was so disgraceful to be captured. But anyway, his last post in his career was the news editor in Norwich, and he's the man who offered me a job at the BBC in Norwich in September 1962, when I didn't have a job. And it was, as I say, pure nepotism, but it worked for me. I never had a day for any time, so much as a day's training in journalism or script writing or talking to cameras or anything. You just picked it up as you went along.
First job.
I'm pretty sure it was sitting on a horse. It was an Arabian horse in a stud farm south of Norwich, and I forget why we were doing it, but it was a very undistinguished piece of television news, such as it was. I worked for a program called Look East, which still exists. I think it was launched in 1963, and it was bad. It was, I think, probably consistently the worst program ever produced by the BBC, week in, work, week out. And Sir Hugh Green, who was then the Director General, obviously saw it. He went home early one Friday to his home in Bury St Edmunds. He switched on the television. He couldn't believe how bad it was, and he sent the editor of Panorama up there to instruct us in the basics of, I suppose, the only... It wasn't a proper instruction, but he tried to whip us into shape. No, it wasn't good. But fortunately, all the early news films I did about floods and the openings of sewage farms and horses and so on, they've all been lost. And I'm grateful for that. But it was a good training, because everything we did had to be done very briefly. We were shooting film. This was years before videotape. And the processing place in Norwich could only handle 100 foot of film at a time, and 100 foot is 2 minutes and 40 seconds, so any interview you did had to be within 2 minutes and 40 seconds, and any story you did really had to be on. If you could do it on 100 foot of film, it would be easier to edit. So that taught me the virtues of brevity, keeping it short.
Did you go to London at all, you know, to the BBC?
Hardly at all. Once in 90, I was assigned there for a week to expand my repertoire, if you like. I was assigned there as a sub-editor. It must have been in 1960, early summer of 64. I remember labouring all day on a script about the UN involvement in Congo. Well, there weren't many reporters out in the field in those days. It was a 12-minute bulletin, as it was called, mostly with the big names, Robert Dougal, Richard Baker, Michael Aspel, reading scripts, what we put in front of them. And it took me all, and I realised that there was much more rigorous editorial process than there is now, both in fact-checking and in matters of style and vocabulary. It was quite a rigorous regime. And if they didn't like it, they sent it back. And I remember we had an editor called Derek Maud, who looked like a pirate. He had a black eye patch over one eye or the other, and it shifted. And he was always battling with the prolixity of his reporters and sub-editors. And I put this in my book. He said, "Son, never forget that the greatest story in the world was told in two words: Jesus wept." So that was what I spent a week there. But apart from then, September 64, there was a job opening as a general news reporter in London. I auditioned for it. I did an audition tape about the state of the bean harvest, as I remember. And anyway, they accepted me. And in those days, there was what we wanted to know in the business is bimediality, that is, a pool of reporters in radio and television. It came back later in the 1990s as if it were an innovation brought in by John Burt. It wasn't an innovation at all. It was there in 1964, and it ended because it didn't work, because some people were better at one or the other. But by the spring of 65, I'd got my first attachment to television, and once there, they couldn't winkle me out. Because I could write fast, and I looked a bit too young, but that was solved with the passage of time. And so I joined the sort of taxi rank of general news reporters. The big names of the time. The big name of the time was a guy called Peter Woods, who was big in BBC, joined ITN, came back to us. He would do the big bank robberies in Mayfair, and I would do the small bank robberies in Wood Green. There was definitely a pecking order. Until, you know, one day you're the bloke nearest the door when there's a foreign war or something, and off you go. And my opening came with the overthrow of Kwame Nkrumah. It must have been in 1965 or 1966. I'm getting dodgy on dates. And I sort of went out there with a VisNews cameraman, an agency cameraman, and did my best for 10 days, and it was all right. I'd never done it before. I was immensely worried that I was going to fail this first big test, because all the network knew. There was just us and ITN. There were no other players in the game. Working to a pretty shared agenda, we both felt we knew what news was. This was long before the dumbing down, and we knew what news was. And it was competitive. And, of course, there were no satellites. So you had to ship your film out somehow, find somebody travelling to London, take it in their baggage or something. So the news would reach London weeks later. And you could get up radio circuits, but they weren't much in the way of television. So the logistical challenges were extremely, extremely heavy. And there were no producers or anything. You just went off and did the business.
Going off to something like that, you know, did you have briefings about the situation?
No, I was in such a hurry that I left my car in the short-term car park at Heathrow. And because if I hadn't, I wouldn't have caught the plane. And when I came back, it cost me £26. Now, £26 was a lot of money in those days. Now, there's no briefing. I mean, if you were lucky, you had time to get a few cuttings from the library about where it was and what Kwame Nkrumah was. We knew very little. Likewise, my second foreign assignment, which was the massacres of Igbos, the Easterners who were in northern Nigeria, were massacred in the summer of 1966, a great uprising against them. Terrible things happened. Those who survived fled back to Biafra. And I did the... It was a very difficult story to cover because on touching down at Kano Airport in northern Nigeria, I was immediately arrested. It was my first experience of being arrested because what the Nigerian government did not want was a television crew roaming around recording these massacres, least of all a television crew from the old colonial power. This was only 6 years after independence, and it was the breakdown of the structures that the British had left in place. So I was deported, but so incompetently that they put me on a plane to Lagos instead of a plane back to London. And from Lagos, I managed to work my way over to Enugu, the capital of what was then eastern Nigeria, and became briefly Biafra, and I met Colonel Ajukwu, who was the military governor, and eventually who led the secession. Now, they had a story to tell because the survivors were streaming back, and it was a terrible example of what we now, I suppose, call ethnic cleansing. So it was my first experience of that. And I suppose I was very sympathetic to Ojukwu. He's what you might call a white man's black man, a little bit like Savimbi. Very fluent in many languages, charismatic. And he led his people to independence in... well, they seized it in 67, and the rebellion lasted until January 1970. And it attracted huge sympathy from the world outside. It was very difficult for the Wilson government, which was actually arming the federal forces. There was it was the great cause célèbre of foreign policy in Britain, much more than Vietnam, actually. But it's all largely forgotten now. Some African leaders actually sided with the rebels. I believe Kaunda did for a while, Houphouet Boigny in the Ivory Coast, I think the Gabon and one other. But of course it cracked under the pressure of the Organization of African Unity. Britain was instrumental in, I mean Britain lent, we lent mercenary pilots to the Federal Nigerian Air Force. The planes were flown by British officers. And of course none of this ever got out because I couldn't get it past the censorship and I couldn't interview these people because they wouldn't be interviewed. It was just something I knew. And eventually the rebels were starved out. I mean, a much better witness of this is Freddie Forsyth, who was there with them. I tended to report the war when it started from the federal side. I was back there when Enugu fell. It must have been in the autumn of 1969. And these bush wars are really frightening. You got up and you schmoozed your way to the front line. That took a lot of doing. And it was, the distances were huge. The roadblocks were almost insuperable. But eventually I got there. We set out, Enugu, the capital, had fallen. We set out from Enugu in an armored column, without meaning to say one or two armored cars at the front. The rest of the troops just walking behind. And that was I, the only white face in this whole bunch. I should have blacked up. Until you run into the Biafran counterfire, and then everybody, all hell breaks loose. But we were generally pushing forward. It was an instructive, quite scary. Very scary. I mean, one of the scariest experiences I've had, because you know, if you stay alive, it's more by luck than judgment. But I only had a local cameraman at the time. And I said only because I think the BBC didn't rate it as a story, or they had all their staff crews somewhere else. They had a plucky little Nigerian who did the business. And I think we did quite well, but I'm sure the tapes, the film's lost, you know. But it had a big impression on me. And I remember the brigadier commanding the column, Brigadier Dan Juma. He didn't last very long. He was executed some years later on suspicion of plotting a coup. You know. But it was an interesting grounding in warfare. I'd never done a bush war before, and I'm not sure I'd like to do one again. It's a bit tough.
It seems you're very much on your own, aren't you? You were the only white man.
I was the only white man there. Yeah. And obviously, and each side is looking for mercenaries on the other. Each side had mercenaries. I mean, the Biafrans probably rather more. I think Freddie Forsyth's Day of the Jackal was written by talking to Belgian and French mercenaries he met while both reporting on the Biafrans and indeed fighting alongside them, because at one point he left and just joined them as a commando, which was a very brave thing for him to do. I at that time adopted as a general principle that I tried not any more than was necessary to travel with rebel armies, because you know the odds are so stacked against you. I did it once in Salvador. I was really scared, you know, because you can be picked up crossing the lines both ways, and then if you're picked up by the government side, they'll be absolutely merciless because you're a spy, they think. So I didn't do that very much, and it took braver people than I to do that. I mostly would work with more or less established military forces.
So did you go into Biafra at all during the...
Before independence, yes. And I think I obviously interviewed Ojukwu, and I gave a fairly... I certainly set out the grievances they had against the federal authorities. But when the war started, I was entirely on the federal side, and Freddie Forsyth was on the Biafran side. And I think he was probably the only reporter we had for a significant length of time on the Biafran side.
So you wouldn't have witnessed firsthand the sort of starvation?
No, I didn't do that. For that, you'd have to go to somebody like Freddie or Michael Nicholson or Gerald Seymour of ITN, who were both there at different times.
I expect you were well aware of the reporting of that, though, weren't you? Yes,
very much so, except that it also coincided with a period of high conflict in Northern Ireland. And by that, this I'm talking now about 1969, and by that time I'd been switched to Northern Ireland. So I sort of lost my perspective on Biafra.